The Philosophy of Childing, How to Look to Children to Become More Creative and Curious. It's often said children are natural philosophers. In fact, some theorists believe that we adults should look to children for some clues on how to unlock our powers of reasoning. I'm Keith Shortall. If you want to insult someone, tell them they're being childish and that they should grow up. But my guests today would argue that children are in a perpetual state of questioning and are better at finding connections in life. So why do we lose that sense of wonder? And how can we rediscover the joy of seeking answers to big questions, of trying new things? And how can we learn from children as we discuss big issues with people who don't agree with us? We'll also explore ways to introduce the great philosophers to young minds. Kids and Philosophy, today on Main Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. We've all heard how children learn best when they're young. And what about what children can teach us? Today I have two guests who will share their take on teaching philosophy to the young and on what young thinkers can teach us. With me in studio today, Christopher Phillips, author and educator. He's best known for his 2001 book, Socrates Cafe. Public Radio International called Phillips the Johnny Appleseed of philosophy. His newest book is The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. And joining us from the studios of WVFT in Charlottesville, Virginia, is Marietta McCarty, author of the bestseller Little Big Minds, Sharing Philosophy with Kids. And as always, we want to hear from you as well. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, both of you, to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Marietta, we'll start with you. Your book part of your career really has been devoted to this commitment, I guess, to introducing great thinkers to young minds. You've taught philosophy to adults as well as your career. But how did you get to this idea that that kids were sort of natural philosophers, and that was it during a tennis teaching, or what was the connection there?
Well, Keith, I think that as I look back on it now, what I didn't realize at the time that I decided to take philosophy to children, that I had really been introduced to philosophy by my father. We would have long talks about generosity. And I mean, I was 6, 7, 8 years old, about the passage of time, about why there's never an excuse for rudeness. And I grew up in a home and with relatives and friends and who were great with my curiosity and encouraged it. And then when I began to teach tennis, if you study philosophy, you should always have a backup career, I think. And so I ran a tennis camp for many summers. And when it rained, the children loved to have our philosophy sessions at the tennis camp. And they were brilliant. And so I incorporated discussions of why is sportsmanship important. And so I think it's just been part of my sort of cellular makeup all along. So when I began to teach at a community college, I thought it was important for my job to take philosophy to the larger service region, which is a very big one that the college serves. And so I thought the best way to do that is to follow the yellow school bus. And so I began to go around all over Central Virginia and then around the country sharing philosophy with children.
One story that from Socrates that you share initially, is my understanding, is the myth of the cave. Can you explain?
Yes. It,
just remind us what that is and why it works for the purposes that you use it.
I think the reason that it works is that children can picture it. My college students can picture it, that what it's like to be in a dark place and not be able to see things clearly. But if that's all you've ever known is this dark, cramped place, then you think that's what's real and you accept that as the truth. And so children love to imagine, and we look at a lot of pictures of caves from all over the world – climbing out and it begins to get more bright and you begin to see things more differently and there's a brand new world out there. And part of what intrigues children is that we talk a lot about the fact this isn't so easy to go back and realize that you might need to change your mind or learn things that you had never imagined. But how wonderful can this be? How full of awe might our lives be to have this world opening up in the sunlight? And so I think that's what works, that maybe there is a better way of understanding what courage is, for example, or friendship or happiness. What really does it mean to be a good person? You've heard that word. You're 8, 9 years old or 39 or 40 years old, but what does it really mean to be a good person? Let's think about this all over again as if for the first time. And I think that the whole notion of the climb to a better mental life is really quite inviting for philosophers of all ages.
And we'll get into more of those examples of teaching these big issues or opening discussions about those big questions among younger people. Christopher Phillips, I want to bring you in, though, here, and I think you would share a belief with Marietta that kids have this sort of natural ability or are in such a place that they are naturally curious and therefore make really good philosophers or it's a great starting point for philosophy.
Yeah, I think that they're excellent philosophizers. And they latch on to the Socratic method of inquiring into timely and timeless questions in a way that if they can cultivate it their whole lives long, I think it leads to a really open-ended life of curiosity and creativity through the life of reason, but creative reason all their lives. And so I've been traveling the globe now for 21 years holding inquiries with children at heart of all ages, I like to say.
Explain what the Socrates Cafe is, a brief history.
Yes, and it doesn't have to be at a cafe, but starting in 1996, I started my first Socrates Cafe in Montclair, New Jersey. And the idea was to bring people together of lots and lots of different philosophical, political, religious, or irreligious dispositions and have them inquire with one another, people who typically wouldn't have anything to do with one another, where it was not a debate, not an argument. It was an inquiry and an exploration. And we looked at what's spoken for and against a wide variety of ways of seeing things with the idea that we might well on our own discover uncommon common ground just by sort of going through this form of process inquiry. My goal had been just to start one, but there's still hundreds now around the world. And I think that it speaks to that childlike but by no means childish questioning nature that most of us harbor within but that can get shunted off in the hurly-burly of everyday life.
Well, and let's just explore that briefly. So what happens then? We're this sort of untainted, curious, wise, fascinated little person who finds joy in asking big questions. How does that come to an end? Is it college?
Yes.
Is it philosophy courses in college like I had?
Hopefully not. I mean, life can intervene to be sure, but hopefully that can enrich and enhance an inquiry if you take an hour every week or two. I mean, I come by this fairly honestly. I have dual Greek U.S. citizenship. My yaya, my Greek grandmother, became the first Greek teacher of language and culture in the Tampa Bay region of Florida. And she used to tell me, you know, that we should repeat the feats of Socrates in modern times. But this, but it doesn't have to go by the wayside. It all comes down to us. And so all I tried to do was create this setting where it relied on other people to want it and care enough about it. The first group I started still meets every Tuesday night after nearly 21 years. So it means a lot to folks. And I think that are you going to dramatically change your life, you know, in terms of job or relationship? Maybe not, but I think it would be a dramatic change just by having this form of inquiry on a regular basis.
Marietta, I'm joking about the college classes.
You weren't.
Well, come on
because,
now.
For disclosure, I was a philosophy major, and I was a child at one time, believe it or not. But I think I was fascinated from the beginning by the Greeks, and that's where we started with the Republic and Plato. And I thought this is fantastic, and it was about asking questions, and it's what I do today. I'm a professional question asker, so it was good training. And then I ran headlong into Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and this class where we were to read large chunks of it and spit it back out. And I must say the joy left at that point. So how do you keep it fun here without it becoming so serious and full of itself that it's gone?
Well, I don't know about Christopher, but I tell my students of all ages or an audience at a book event or wherever it is that I'm doing this to have fun, and we're going to have fun, and I learn from it. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest things, is how much the children have brought to me, how much their insights brought to my college students. And I think that part of what we need to do, and I love it when Christopher said that we need to, even if we don't agree, we need to come and sit together, and we need to talk, and we need to listen. And that's, I think, part of the beauty of what happens. And I always ask children why they're in school. And they look at me as if to ask, well, why are you in our school? That's the craziest question I've ever heard. But seriously, you're here 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. What are you doing here? And I am alarmed but no longer surprised that they can't tell me. And so if they do finally manage an answer, it is always some version of, I'm here to get a job. And so we laugh. I say, you know, what kind of jobs are there out there for second graders? And so we play with it a little bit. But then, you know, I can be not only with community college students, but I remember vividly a student at Yale who said the very notion that you talk to children about owning their educations, it makes me dizzy. I have never had a sense of ownership of my education and that it was to liberate me. And so I think that that's part of our failure, is that why education would ever have been considered a drab pursuit, I have no idea. And that's part of the excitement of Plato's, of that climb with Plato out into the sunlight, I think. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Kant is, with three books now, I've encouraged readers to give him a try. It's just that you need to, I do the job of penetrating that material. But children have fun once they understand what he's saying with trying to apply it to their own lives. And I don't know about Christopher, but I have never engaged an audience in the world of ideas and talking about, let's say, what is the meaning of success? Let's rethink the meaning of success, and found that they don't thrive on the opportunity to have a discussion, to listen to what other people have to say, and to feel that there's this relationship brewing through conversation.
Yeah, and yeah. So, not to interrupt, but you're sort of rethinking how we grow up, the stages that we go through, and these sort of rites of passage and the tests we must pass as we move along to the next stage of development.
Yes,
it's maybe.
I mean, as someone who went through the traditional system, and I do question and challenge it, as I now am the father of a 3-year-old and 11-year-old, and I believe that what I've tried to do is alter my entire approach to engaging with young people, and I inquire with them rather than teach them. So we will interrogate a question, a timely and timeless question, typically generated by them.
Can you give an example?
A question, for instance, that I held with indigenous children in Chiapas, Mexico, where my wife and I lived for years, on what is a good person, that they threw out. And they talked about, well, a good person isn't somebody who you identify necessarily with certain qualities, but somebody through certain acts. And I asked for an example. And this one child who can't read, works 7 days a week, said, well, a good person is somebody who at least says no to me with a smile when I try to sell her something. And so it brought in lots of issues of recognition and acknowledgement and identity. So we can go into things maybe after the fact, and I can certainly delve into things like Charles Taylor and identity politics and lots of things. But these children, it's in their bones. It's in their sinew. And so it's transformative for me to have a kind of egalitarian inquiry with our youngest hearts and minds in ways that can lead me down new corridors of inquiry as a scholar and as a practitioner.
Yeah, and I just want to follow up. So you believe that we should take clues from younger people to get some of this natural curiosity and finding connections in the world?
Well, I think the latest cognitive studies, and I go into that a good bit in my newest book, The Philosophy of Children, show that children are natural born, for the most part, there's always exceptions, empathizers, that they reason in a different way than we adults, but they reason nonetheless. And so my opening chapter of The Philosophy of Childhood, the whole book came to be because of an inquiry with kids at an elementary school in Ames, Iowa. They came up with the word. And it turns out that this word childing actually exists, about how to blossom from a healthy core. So they set me on this latest jaunt that turned into, you know, a practical scholarly guide to how we can flourish at every age and stage of life.
And childing, the reference there, the idea is that instead of parenting to children to bring them, mm-hmm. to haul them, kicking and screaming to the right. next stage of where they should be, maybe we could be childed by them to
right.
reintroduce
with
us.
This idea that at every age and stage of life, we always are souls who have strengths and weaknesses, experiences and insights, and that it behooves us to inquire with one another from time to time as relative equals, recognizing that we occupy different space and that children tend to look at things wholly and clearly in a way that we adults no longer do. So if we can explain to them some of these highfalutin $50 words in more understandable terms, they can actually help us in our own inquiries and pathways.
Mariette, explain, for example, I think there was – I saw somewhere where you had a discussion with kids about the asking the question about, you know, what does it mean to be courageous or what is courage? Explain that – use that as an example to explain what we get from kids.
Well, I think – that for children, the notion that courage isn't some special possession of a firefighter or a pilot or someone who climbs Mount Everest, but it's something that they can cultivate for themselves is a wonderful thing for children. And to find out that it may not be what you an act always that appears to be what you would normally consider brave. For example, it may be – the courageous thing may be to say, I'm going to be the only one that doesn't jump into the pool because I can't swim yet. And so that would be a look at what courage is. And so for many of the children that I've worked with over the years – They come from very difficult lives, and courage is really important to them to be able to realize, for example, what's in my power. I can be reasonable about this. So what can I control and what can't I in this situation? What would be the wise thing for me to do that would allow me to face this difficulty with courage? So I think that for children, the fact that it's something that they can better understand and that they can decide what it means in the particular circumstances of their lives is very freeing.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. I think that I remember one inquiry with a child, and she said, well, for my mother, courage is having the wherewithal to get out of bed in the morning. Her mother suffered from a debilitating mental illness. For the children that I began these dialogues with in Mission District of San Francisco, they talked about how their families had crossed the desert to get into the United States and whether that was courageous but with also a mix of foolhardiness. So there's these things are on their minds, and it expands their range and realm of possibilities when they have a regular opportunity to inquire.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Northeast Delta Dental. Dental benefits for businesses of all sizes, including individual and family plans. Details at northeastdeltadental.com.
Journalism is more than news. It's more than politics. It's more than what happens day to day. Journalism is about human lives. And public broadcasting, particularly Maine Public, does such a splendid job of giving us a light into the lives of our fellow citizens. We learn about people whose experiences have been different from ours, things that bind us more closely together and gives us a sense of that shared experience, makes for stronger communities, and only Maine Public is there to give us that illumination that makes us more connected. As a resource for the people of Maine, there's nobody that reports better on the State House. There's nobody that reports better on things that are going on of great interest to the state of Maine, whether they're features or breaking news stories, than Maine Public Broadcasting. It's a treasure, it's a resource, and we're very, very fortunate to have it. I'm Brenda Garand. I'm from Portland, and I support a bold future for Maine Public Broadcasting.
We're charting a bold future. Won't you join us? Hi, Charles Beck here, inviting you to tune in next Tuesday on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television as we cross the finish line on Maine Public's comprehensive campaign to strengthen public media here in Maine for you and your community in the years ahead. We'll hear testimonials from some of you and your neighbors, and over on the television side Tuesday evening, we'll see a preview of Ken Burns' latest, The Vietnam War, and we hope that you'll jump on board with your support. If you'd like to make a gift right now, you can. The number to call is 1-800-866-1475, or you can always pledge online at mainepublic.org. And we thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Philosophy and Children. With me in studio, Christopher Phillips. He's an author and educator. His latest book is The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. Joining us from a studio in Charlottesville, Virginia, is Marietta McCarty. She's the author of the bestseller Little Big Minds, Sharing Philosophy with Kids. What questions do you have? The number, 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Part of what we're talking about are the big questions, introducing kids to great thinkers, learning from kids how to reinvigorate our own curiosity. But there's also something about that's important about how to have these discussions. Mm-hmm. Much of what we see in media now are shouting matches, opinion pieces, mm-hmm. sort of dueling opinions. There's a great love of opinion. Mm-hmm. But Christopher, let's go back to the Socratic dialogue and this method. Is this something that you think has real benefit to, you know, recreating the way that we have public discussions, even mm-hmm. about major issues?
I think that if we don't first engage in an inquiry into foundational questions, timely and timeless questions, where it requires us to listen carefully to what others have to say, to the point that we quit looking at them as the other. If we don't listen with all of our being, I think the art and science of listening has gotten really short shrift. I don't know how democracy can evolve. I don't know how we can become more open selves that can sort of lead to a more open society if we don't practice and cultivate that habit. I've been pleasantly thrilled that this notion has caught on far and wide. I mean, we have four very long-going groups here in Maine that people like this. They realize this isn't a knock-down, drag-out, one-upmanship, browbeating thing. This is an inquiry where we have to listen if we're going to build on to what others said. So once they get into that sort of riffing where they might discover thoughts they didn't even know they harbored, it becomes like somebody who doesn't know what's going to be on the next page of a book or the next chapter, and they come back again and again. Well, it taps into that sense of mystery, but a mystery that can be further discerned and discovered as the inquiry progresses. So hopefully it's one that never comes to an end.
And Marietta, are kids better at this because they're more empathetic or because they don't have an immediate emotional response in the midst of a conversation? What is it that they have that we've lost?
I think they have more space in their minds, more empty space for new ideas. They just don't have the baggage and the clutter. You mentioned the word opinions, the assumptions, things that we've said and have never really considered why we believe that. The children really haven't gotten that far yet, fortunately. And I love hearing Christopher talk about conversation and listening, because I think the word crisis is not too strong for what's happening to us as a democracy, that it's so difficult and rare to have a good conversation. And it never ceases to amaze me that the number one topic that I'm asked to speak about, and most of what I get emails about, is how to have a conversation, this open-ended, as you suggest, a questioning and wonder and further probing into what can remain a mystery. But it's the questioning. It's the possession of what Russell called the goods of the mind that's so healthy. So no matter what it is, whether the Jefferson Society at the University of Virginia is a debate society, what did they want me to talk about? Well, let's talk about children doing philosophy and how we can have better conversations. And it's a debate society that meets every week. So that I think, is a crisis as we become – I saw it walking to the studio here today in Charlottesville, people standing around together on cell phones. And so we're nobody's talking to each other with this thing that I think is very dear to Christopher and to me.
Let's take a call here. We'll go to Waterville. And Ellery. Hi, Ellery. Welcome to the program. Ellery, can you hear me? No. All right. Sorry about that. We'll try. Let's see if we can.
We have a Socrates Cafe in Waterville. I wonder if she's part of that.
I'm not sure. We'll see why the board isn't bringing up our callers here. I'm not hearing anything. Marietta, let me go back to you and give an – I want to sort of explore another example of how you get into conversations using philosophy, for example, around the subject of friendship.
Yes. So there's an example of a topic to discuss with children that it's a word that they know and they have friends and the word's used all the time. But what does it really mean? And so looking at that, again, for children who've taken the word for granted is really helpful to them, not only in wanting friendships in their lives, but in thinking about how they can be better friends themselves. And that's what I look at a lot. It's not so much, you know, how could Joan be a better friend to you? But what do you need to work on? What would you like to develop in yourself mm-hmm. to be worthy of your own self-respect mm-hmm. and to earn it and then to make a good friend to other people in your lives?
Mm-hmm. I have about scores of YouTube dialogues that you can access off our SocratesCafe.com page with one-on-one dialogues with me and my oldest daughter, Callie, who's almost 11. And she'll come home from school and I'll say, well, what's a question on your mind that we can interrogate philosophically based on what's happened? And she goes, well, should you always be loyal to your friends? And it turns out that one of her friends had taken something. And we talked about when you should stand up and when you – maybe loyalty is actually letting somebody know what happened. And so in getting into the nuances of these things, kids are quite capable of doing. And it can create further bonds of what the Greeks of old called philia, which is a kind of friendship not just between one person and another, but that can create deeper ties between yourself and members of your community and society.
And
wasn't
it fun to be surprised by your daughter? I mean, I'm surprised all the time by children that somehow the conversation I remember with this one group was when we were talking about, you know, the future and what it held, and they were imagining what their lives would be.
So
they began to imagine their occupation. And one child said, when I grow up, I want to be kind.
It's really
true.
And I thought,
yes, I want to be kind
when
I grow up.
I recently had
that
a dialogue.
That beats an occupation.
Yeah. I had an inquiry with kids in Hiroshima who had just visited the Peace Park there. And they're and kids, even though they might not have the depth and wells of experiences of adults, they do have lots of the hopes and fears and concerns. And so they'll leave something like this with all these idealistic notions of how they can make sure in their own way that what happened then can never happen again. And it's a beautiful thing to behold because it can be transformative for the older folks taking part in these inquiries. I hope in my events tonight and tomorrow there's a healthy contingent of young people so older folks can see just what they can do.
Why don't you share with us what those events are before we forget?
Okay. I'll be at Barnes & Noble tonight in Augusta, Maine at 7 p.m. And then I'll be at the Public Library in Cape Elizabeth tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. to have at it philosophically with kids of all ages.
I want to go back and I'm a little curious about, I guess – why we lose this. Is it arrogance? Is it, I'm older now and I've been to college, therefore I know this. Is there pressure for us to appear that we know everything, or is it a cultural sort of disdain of intellectual exercise?
Well, I was just at a university in New England, and one of the students who took part in my inquiry said that a question that she had asked her elementary school teacher that she had been put down. She had been told, enough. I don't want to hear any more questions. To this day, as an 18-year-old, she was saying how much it affected her, that she felt like she was now worried about only asking the right questions, the questions that their teacher wanted them to hear. So if that becomes, if that natural questioning nature isn't validated early and often, I think that that in and of itself can lead people to being intimidated as they grow older and go through the formal hallowed halls and just having their curiosity encouraged and fanned at every opportunity.
Yeah. Yes, I've had students come to see me in the office after the first couple of classes, and you know they're really anxious. This, no one has ever asked me what I thought before. And I, can you talk to me about that?
Isn't that something?
And so they describe the educational process, and a huge concern. I think that that's a topic. One reason I talk to children about why they're in school, to college students about why they're here, is to make sure that they're aware of that charge and that excitement and the purpose every day. And so if we lose that, if, you know, the Brazilian sort of renegade rebel educator philosopher Freire talked all the time about we can't fall to the banking method where we just stuff information in people's heads and expect them to give that back to us. That keeps us in our place. Mm-hmm. It makes for no change in society, and it doesn't give children or students of any age the tools to change their lives. And that's what I've tried to do is give students of all ages tools and have fun as we do it.
Yes. You know, Freire had worked with adults and kids. Mm-hmm. He was a big believer in the fact that we can keep that malleability of mind that we start out with in life if we're continually encouraged to ask questions and to explore and to delve. But all too often, the powers that be don't want us to. Look at what happened ancient Athens. It wasn't any accident that people suddenly turned in on themselves. This form of questioning and inquiry was discouraged. One might say that this kind of public inquiry today is being discouraged. So all the more the reason for those of us who care about an open society to gather in public places and show that very different people can inquire in ways that they do connect further and deeper.
Let's try – we apologize, Ellery, for not connecting with you earlier. We'll try you now. Ellery, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
All right. Well, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. An excellent discussion. I appreciate it. A couple of quick points. Years ago, I heard of Mr. Art Linkletter on his television show saying, end quote, kids say the darndest things. Made me think. Now, even prior to that, I'd always heard the expression for years and years that we as adults sometimes spend a good many of our adult years trying to unlearn or dismiss what we learned or were taught as children. There's so many axioms out there. Kids say that should be seen, not heard. Kids are like little sponges, needed to be filled. So many things out there that seem contradictory. But I was wondering, have your guests heard of any programs in our public schools, lower grades, that actually allow kids to be philosophers, to express themselves? Or has there any movement out there to encourage this wisdom that kids have, this common sense that kids have?
Yeah. Marietta?
I think it's happening all over the country. I think that's the good news. Let me think of two examples come immediately to mind for me. One is from a hardscrabble town in Ohio, hit really, really hard by the Depression. And an intervention specialist in the public school system decided the best thing she could do for the children was to start a philosophy club. And the results of that club have been astonishing. There was a child, Kayla, who through her looking at why bullies bully, which is included in the friendship chapter, and what it means, what human dignity really means, without any discussion, she decided she was just going to love the school bully. And so she decided that she would have lunch with him, that when he did well and answered a question in class, he'd say, good job. And she'd walk with him to the school bus, and the bullying stopped. Marblehead, Massachusetts, in the public schools there, they have a philosophy program. So I know Christopher knows about them, too. It's their clubs. And you know, what we have to decide is whether or not this is important. Mm-hmm. And the fact that critical thinking, this spirit of inquiry, improves test scores in English and math is fine, but I don't think that's the primary reason for doing it. I think it's because it encourages the growth of the full-bodied child who will become a full-bodied and full-minded, full-hearted adult.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. We'll continue the discussion after. The number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Adventure Bound Rafting, offering whitewater rafting, camping, canoeing, and rock climbing vacations for youth and families. AdventureBoundRafting.com.
Maine Public is a part of my daily life. Every day, the radio is on, tuned to Maine Public. In fact, I don't use any other radio stations in the house. When I travel, I now use my Maine Public app, and I still listen to Morning Edition on my iPad rather than the local stations, because I do get information about what's happening in the state legislature and community activities. I find that the news programs provide some in-depth coverage and analysis that I can't get anywhere else. Maine Public Radio is my main source of local news. Aside from the local Booth Bay Register, which I read every week, which is very local, Maine Public makes the state feel like my community. I'm Mary Ann Reynolds. I live on Barters Island in the Booth Bay area, and I support a bold future for Maine Public.
Tomorrow is the day we open the phones here at Maine Public to invite you to help chart a bold future for public broadcasting in Maine. While Super Thursday keeps public broadcasting going, charting a bold future will help us all, together, move it forward for a secure and strong future. A future in which you can count on public media for reliable, trusted journalism, a more widespread classical music network, and a robust online service. As we successfully bring our campaign to a close at the end of this month, tomorrow is your chance to do your part for your trusted and valued public radio, television, or online service. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, two authors on the intersection of children and philosophy. With me today, Christopher Phillips, author and educator, best known for his 2001 book, Socrates Cafe, his latest book, The Philosophy of Childing. Joining us from a studio in Charlottesville, Virginia, is Marietta McCarty, author of bestseller Little Big Minds. Her website is MariettaMcCarty.com. Join the conversation, the number 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll take a call here in a second, but I just wanted to share a personal experience, and maybe you as philosophy people experience this as well. When I would tell others that I was majoring in philosophy in college, they looked, you know, cross-eyed at me as if I was crazy, and the question was always the same, well, what are you going to do with that? Mm-hmm. And at the top, Marietta, you even joked, if you're a philosophy teacher, you have to have a backup job. There is this real, I won't call it a disdain, mm-hmm. but really intense skepticism mm-hmm. of this discipline called philosophy, it mm-hmm. seems, in our culture in many ways. Why is that, Christopher?
Yeah, I think it can be applied even to the liberal arts as a whole, that there seems to be less and less of a sense that this is something that one can pursue and make a gainful living later on in life. However, if you look at many of our best writers and journalists, they started out with degrees in philosophy, or they read and studied it somehow deeply, even if autodidactically. So I think it can serve as a foundation for just about anything and everything that you might want to delve into. At its origins, at its beginnings, philosophy was the inquiry, methodical inquiry into just about anything over and under and through the sun. To the extent that we've lost that in the discipline of philosophy itself, and it's become sort of just an academic exercise where it's a lot of microscopists writing in highfalutin jargon, I think that we've lost the heart and soul of what philosophy can be. We can philosophize with people from any experience and learn something, glean something that can help us in our scholarly, academic, professional inquiries, in our humanistic inquiries. And I think we need to capture that sort of lifeblood of what philosophy was meant to be in the first place, because I think it has kind of lost its way in the academic confines.
I saw a picture of Immanuel Kant while you were talking about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Marietta, did you want to add anything before we?
Yes, I was going to say that I would make a good case for philosophy being as practical as anything you could possibly study, because what directs our lives are the contents of our mind. It's the ideas in my mind that determine everything that I do. So if I want to make good choices, if I want to understand what the good life is, I've got to have a mind that's in good shape. Mm-hmm. And I think that practically speaking, to have an agile, curious, open mind it will benefit a person all their lives. It will be the heart of their life. Mm-hmm. I think that, Martin Luther King suggested that, if your mind's in good shape, your heart will follow. And mm-hmm. so if your heart's not right, King said, you better fix it today. And I think that when we get our minds more clear about the meaning of empathy, for example, the meaning of love, then we'll make better choices. So I think nothing could be more practical. I think if we're living in a consumer society, that's something that's devoted to mental stimulation, you can't. What will it get me? Well, and I also think that Christopher is right on when academic philosophers have removed it from the life of ordinary people with the jargon, and I think by and large by design, so that they're writing for themselves, and you can't mm-hmm. understand it. I mean, Kant's impossible to understand. And so,
thank you. Finally,
I think though that you mentioned Plato's Republic at the outset, and he has Socrates say that we're not looking into any chance question, but everything we delve into and inquire into should help us answer that question of questions: how should one live? And I mm-hmm. think that's what we do when we inquire philosophically and we use a method that can open up some new portals of possibility. By cultivating thoughtfulness, reasonableness in an empathic way as we're young, I don't see how it can't help but steer us in new and exciting directions as individuals and as a society. So it's just a tradition that we're trying to recapture.
For the record, I really did admire my professor at the time. He was very good.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. You seem tortured and tormented.
It's not an indictment of him. He was great.
I'm looking at you. Yeah.
Let's go to Harvey in Augusta. Hi, Harvey.
Yes. A couple of comments based on your discussion of listening earlier. One was in the face of the current political debate where everybody's on the far end of the conversation but nobody in the middle listening to anybody else. When somebody makes a comment that you disagree with, whether it's political or any other thing, instead of trying to correct them, because you, of course, know it all, you ask them how did they come to that conclusion or why did they think the way they just said, mm-hmm. and that could, and then actually listen to what they say. This could easily, save you a friend losing argument, and you might even learn something. The other comment was from a paper I wrote years ago about a church building project planning sessions that really went the wrong way. The comment was that in the course of this, the idea is to get as many people involved as possible. And when old Joe, that you've known since kindergarten and has never had an original thought in his life, gets up to speak or starts to speak, instead of, thinking of who he is and mm-hmm. what his background is, try to pretend that he's a consultant from a distant city that you're paying a high amount of money to be there, and listen, and surprisingly, he may come up with a very overlooked, obvious
I think there's so much truth in that.
Sorry, Harvey, we're almost out of time, so I want to give
Harvey,
you a chance
I hope
to respond.
You're in Augusta, so I hope you come to my event tonight at the Barnes & Noble there at 7. The whole idea is that we're storytellers, but my lament is that we don't listen to one another's stories so much anymore. Let's use the life of reason and the life of these timeless questions to become those storytellers again and listen to one another, because I think if we do, chances are good that we can kind of recover the terrain in our democracy that'll make it open and evolving again. I think that's so important. I hope the same holds true tomorrow when I'm at the Public Library and Cape Elizabeth, but that this whole idea, this whole questioning and listening tradition, the two go hand in glove if we recapture that storytelling tradition.
Yeah, and so when you say, Marietta, when we restore this tradition, can we literally learn from kids in this way? I mean, is this something that they do automatically?
Yes. Children will show us the way to do this. And they are so hungry to be listened to. Mm-hmm. And I spend time with children getting them to sit quietly. And they don't get to do that very much in this society. And so by sitting quietly, they can find that they can listen better and they're more calm and they can think better. Mm-hmm. And I suggest, listen to yourself sometime. A child came and told me, he said, Ms. McCarty, I did listen to myself, and I got to tell you, there's somebody in my head, and they are really loud.
Mm.
And so, yes, children can show us. I mean, the things that children have said over the years are absolutely amazing, and I couldn't wait to get back to the college to tell my college students. And then the children would come, and they'd have a picnic together, the children and the college students. The college students were completely intimidated by the children.
I remember there was a story, I think, you told about how you had taught kids when they were very young and later went to college and referred back to their journals that they kept because they wanted to remember how they thought about things.
That's one of my favorite things, Keith, actually, is seeing those tattered journals. So I suggest that children and also adults keep a journal of their thoughts, and they write things down, if not during a philosophy class, afterwards. And so I will sometimes run into the child philosophers when they are in college or when they've graduated from college, and mm-hmm. they still have these tattered journals that they first started, and they said, you know, I understood. Jesse said once, I understood then, and I could feel my understanding slipping away as I got older. And so I like to go back to when my mind was fresh and I really was clear about what's important and how to live.
You know, when I was a teacher here in Maine in a 6-room schoolhouse in Casco, I had 37 kids per class. So the only really meaningful experience that any of us had was when we got in these circle groups and started talking about things that were matters of the heart. And I think that once we realize that we're all in this together, and once we really, really start not just having a conversation, but not just saying what we think, but why we think what we think, it can serve as the platform for really greater civic participation, because now we realize what we say and think and do really does matter and count.
Marietta, Christopher, thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure.
Marietta McCarty, author of the best-selling book Little Big Minds, Sharing Philosophy with Kids. Christopher Phillips, an author and educator, best known for his 2001 book Socrates Cafe, his newest book, The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. For those of you in the Augusta area, Christopher will be signing books at the Barnes & Noble there tonight at 7 p.m. He'll be in Cape Elizabeth at the library tomorrow at 6:30. Visit the Maine Calling website or Facebook page for more information. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Sam Dearen answered your calls with additional help from our Dow interns, Jill Baker and Isabel Fall. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about bridging the political divide. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.